thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on vacation. President Obama reaffirms his commitment to withdraw most U.S. combat forces from Iraq by September 1st. The United States pledges tens of millions of dollars in aid to Pakistan as it deals with record floods. And a Vietnam-era general has his honor and stars restored some 40 years after he became a fall guy for the Nixon administration. Joining us for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup are Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, Elise Labatt of CNN, and James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank
you. Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, the government yesterday charged 14 people, citizens and green card holders mostly, in Minnesota, California, and Alabama, was supporting a, quote, deadly pipeline of money and fighters to a terrorist group in Somalia. James Kitfield, tell us about it.
Well, it is really an example of this new sort of form of threat in the terrorism world, where we're seeing a lot of more homegrown American citizens, people who have passports that are very worrisome to the FBI and the intelligence community because they can travel freely, you know, back and forth. We've seen this in Pakistan as well as in Yemen. We have the, you know, American sort of preacher there who's sort of an al-Qaeda linked guy who was the inspiration behind the Denver shooter. In this case, we've seen already a number of Somali Americans, a lot of them from a diaspora around Minneapolis, disappear and show up in martyrdom videos, suicide bombings, and jihadist videos in Somalia. Now, they go to fight the African Union peacekeeping force and before that, the Ethiopian army that was in Somalia. But this group, al-Shabaab, is closely linked with al-Qaeda, and it has started to launch suicide bombing attacks outside of Somalia. In some countries in Africa that are supporting the African Union peacekeeping force. So they're starting to show a little bit al-Qaeda-like philosophy that you attack, you know, outside of the major combat zone. That's very scary to American counterintelligence officials who see these guys can travel freely to the United States. They're training over there. They're getting, you know, suicide vest training, how to make bombs. And so they apparently rounded up this pipeline that was feeding them to Somalia.
Elise, we had the Obama administration release a report yesterday dealing with terrorism and this issue of homegrown terrorists.
That's right. Well, as James said, the Somali community in America has, particularly Minnesota, has been of a lot of concern. But the whole issue of homegrown terrorism and disaffection of particularly Muslim Americans in the United States seeking to go out across the world to do to train with these terrorist groups. And the State Department's terrorism report came out yesterday, said this is a huge concern. And they really, and I think you heard not only the State Department, but Attorney General Eric Holder say yesterday that the U.S. really needs to redouble its efforts at prevention, really reaching out to these disaffected would-be Americans, or in some of the cases are Americans. We've seen a lot of this in Europe, where Muslim immigrants have had a real problem assimilating into the country, and you've seen, you know, a lot of extremism kind of sow among their ranks. And so the State Department said it really needs to kind of redouble its efforts. It's also talked about al-Shabaab, this Somali terrorist group, as an al-Qaeda affiliate, one of the most active right now. These Africa-based al-Qaeda affiliates are some of the most active in the world and are really concerned about al-Shabaab. So the nexus between these Somali Americans and al-Shabaab, very concerning.
Jonathan.
And what this also points out is kind of how these franchises of al-Qaeda Central, located reportedly in Pakistan's tribal region, are kind of self-generating and following this script that was set originally by Osama bin Laden and his chief lieutenant Zawahiri, and generating themselves, building themselves up in places like North Africa, in Yemen, even in places like Europe.
Elise, go ahead.
It's kind of worth noting that this al-Awlaki, who is believed to be one of the big operators now of al-Qaeda in al-Shabaab and other in Yemen and other places consider him one of the main targets right now of the U.S. in terms of al-Qaeda. And they, you know, they don't want to call him the next bin Laden, but they're certainly spending a lot of time and energy trying to find him, perhaps kill him. This is an American citizen. And the whole idea that American citizens are so disaffected that they're going to join al-Qaeda and target Americans is really worrying to the U.S.
He's actually – interesting development this week is ACLU actually filed a court case to challenge the fact that this American citizen is on a capture or kill list. And more frequently, those are kill lists because they're drone – they're usually targeted with drone strikes. So it is interesting that they think this guy is a big enough threat to put him on a capture or kill list even though he's an American citizen.
We also had developments involving Vietnam this week. Now, Elise, you were in Vietnam just 2 weeks ago with Secretary of State Clinton, but new details out this week on talks between the United States and Vietnam that would allow Hanoi to enrich its own uranium. Now, that's at odds with what has been the U.S. policy towards some other countries.
Well, what the U.S. has been doing is forming these called so-called 1-2-3 agreements with various countries to share civil nuclear technology. And it's really not only a way to export U.S. technology in this field, but also to kind of keep more regulation over the nuclear industry and make sure that countries, while they have a right to peaceful nuclear energy, do not try to build a nuclear weapon. And these are under strict monitoring by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog. And so with Vietnam, they're saying that, you know, Vietnam can enrich its own uranium. This is how the negotiations are shaping up. Every country has a right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement to enrich uranium. The U.S. would prefer that countries don't. You see what's happening with Iran. It's exercising its right to enrich uranium. The U.S. believes they're doing that under the guise of building a nuclear weapon. And so they prefer that these countries don't. But what they'd really like is to have what they call the gold standard of nuclear agreements, like the UAE recently signed, where they gave up the right to enrich. Vietnam doesn't want to actually give up its right, but it's saying we really don't want to give up. We really don't want to do it anyway. So the U.S. really doesn't feel that strongly about – they prefer that they didn't, but they're not worried because they're not going to anyway.
Nevertheless, experts in nonproliferation and arms control are somewhat exercised over what they see as a double standard by the Obama administration when it comes to these kinds of agreements. Let's not forget that the Obama administration was a hard supporter of the agreement between the United States and India on the sharing of nuclear technology and India is not. It allows Indian plants to forego international inspection. And again, there are agreements, these so-called 1-2-3 agreements, which, by the way, have to be approved by Congress where it comes to the Middle East, where these countries forego their right to enrichment. And so, as I said, a lot of some nuclear experts see a double standard in the Obama administration policy on this.
James.
I totally agree with that. I think they're stepping on their own message. I mean, he's made nonproliferation one of the key tenets of his foreign policy. We've seen it with the New START agreement, with the nuclear summit we had here in February in Washington. My colleague here is right. You do have the right to enrichment, civil enrichment for a civil program under the NPT, but it's a weakness and a loophole in the NPT that everyone understands needs to be fixed. And that's why the Obama administration says we need an international fuel bank that sort of you keep control over enrichment and then dole out to these civilian reactors as needed. And this kind of steps on that message. It says, you know, you're allowing someone to have enrichment, even though Vietnam helpfully has said we're not that interested in it.
And also, you have to look at China as well. I mean, the U.S. says this is between the U.S. and Vietnam and China shouldn't be a factor here. But China is very worried about this. And it kind of fits into the whole policy of what the U.S. is trying to do in South Asia, what Secretary Clinton was doing last week. Not only with Vietnam, she said, you know, it's been the 15-year anniversary of establishing relations with Vietnam. We want to take it to the next level. We're going to get more involved in Southeast Asia. You saw the United States make a big push to try and regulate what's going on in the South China Sea. China is getting very nervous.
going back to the whole question of the double standard, the administration is already seeing blowback from its policies in the form of China pursuing a deal with Pakistan, which has one of the world's worst proliferation records, to sell Pakistan two nuclear reactors. And Pakistan is pointing to the agreement that the United States has with India, saying, well, India has unsafeguarded reactors. Why can't we go ahead and do this?
Well, we're talking about Vietnam. Of course, relations getting much warmer now. But a reminder of the days of the Vietnam War this week, when President Obama asked the Senate to restore the honor and stars to a general after almost four decades. James, what had happened in this case?
Well, General John Lovell was the head of the Air Forces during the Vietnam War, and late in the Vietnam War, and authorized some bombing in North Vietnam that became public. There was an investigation launched by the Pentagon and Congress that found that he had done that and was unauthorized. He was knocked down two stars and sort of forced to retire in disgrace. I mean, this is just one more sorry case of the Vietnam era and Nixon's part in it, because Nixon, turns out, had authorized him to do that, and through the Joint Chiefs. So he did nothing wrong, but Nixon was in a re-election year and let this guy get hung out to dry. They had some of the Nixon tapes now that have been made public show that he felt very uncomfortable with this guy. But you know, when he was asked in a press conference on this, he was willing to let the guy twist in the wind.
These Nixon tapes were so alarming. You hear Nixon and Kissinger both agreeing that it's terrible what's happening to him and doing nothing to stop it.
Yeah, but I think that was really cynical. I mean, this was Nixon trying to rewrite history or create a fact after, that didn't exist. It looked to me, when you read the transcripts of the tapes, it looks more like a cynical ploy for them to cook up their own, we're really sorry, we really didn't want to do this, when in fact they were directly to blame.
Well, we honored General Lovell for his service. We're sorry he didn't survive himself to see his name and honor restored. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the situation in Afghanistan. We'll take your calls. Our lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio for the international hour of our weekly news roundup, Jonathan Landay. He's senior national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Elise Labatt, senior State Department producer for CNN. And James Kitfield, senior correspondent with National Journal Magazine. We're going to go to the phone shortly, take some of your calls and questions, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, lots of strains in the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship over, once again, the issue of corruption. Jonathan Landay, what happened this week?
Well, there is an effort, or there are concerns, that President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan is kind of backtracking on his support for two special task forces that were set up with U.S. help and are being mentored by the U.S., whose job it is to probe corruption. Now, there was a story that came out on how billions, literally billions of dollars in cash have been sent through Kabul Airport to the Gulf. And the investigation into this revealed allegations that one of Karzai's top aides was involved and had in fact taken bribes from the foreign currency company that handled the bulk of these transfers. Well, he was arrested last week. He worked for Karzai's National Security Council based on these investigations by these two task forces. This week, President Karzai orders a commission to review the work of these two special task forces amid concerns that perhaps he's trying to protect not only his staffer who was arrested, but also the foreign exchange company itself, which appears to have connections not only to the Karzai family and other senior officials in Afghanistan, but perhaps alleged connections to the Taliban and narco traffickers as well.
So what is the U.S. response to this, Elise?
Well, you know, the U.S. is in a difficult spot right here because these task forces were seen as a bright spot. The U.S. is using them. In fact, Ambassador Holbrooke, the special rep for Pakistan and Afghanistan, just week is telling Congress these two task forces are bright spots in U.S. efforts to work with Afghanistan on corruption. I mean, you know, Robert Mueller went out there, the FBI director, to kind of inaugurate them. And here they're being held up as these great examples. And now Karzai is trying to say, wait a minute, you know, we need to rejigger them. Not sure really why, whether it's because it's becoming close to his office and who knows how really close it's going to be. Maybe there are political loyalties involved. And also, you know, there are, you know, the U.S. acknowledges some concerns about whether this is, you know, Karzai is claiming that some of these wiretaps and everything is going beyond the Afghan constitution. But what the U.S. is really concerned about here is, on one hand, you know, Afghan corruption is one of the biggest, highest priorities right now for this administration because it is what Afghans cite as the number one thing that fuels their anger at the government, and even more than security right now. And so this is crucial to the U.S. strategy to combat corruption. On the other hand, they don't want to anger Karzai to the point where they isolate him like you saw a few months ago. But you also have Congress, Nita Lowey on the Appropriations Committee has withheld funding because she's very concerned about corruption and wants to make sure that there are you know, regulations in place to make sure that corruption is not taking place and that this needs to be the highest priority. So the U.S. has this delicate balance right now between trying to keep the relationship with Karzai and fighting corruption, which is really urgent right now.
James.
Well, I totally agree with that. And I think the administration is very, very concerned about this. I mean, they see American public support going south on the Afghan war. They see Afghan public support for our presence there going south. And it largely, you know, coalesces around this issue of government corruption. And it's just one more reminder at a really bad time. We've had the McChrystal firing recently. We had the WikiLeaks, you know, release of classified documents that showed that Pakistan was in cahoots with some of the extremist networks that were fighting and are killing American soldiers. And now you have this. We only have a year now left in the Obama surge for Afghanistan. Petraeus has that time basically to buy some goodness, to buy some more time on the clock for the Obama administration in Afghanistan. And every time they seem to be getting, you know, a little momentum, they had, you know, Petraeus comes in on his white horse. You know, Karzai reminds us we're riding a very weak horse in Afghanistan.
I think it's also fair that you need to point out that there's another side to this story, and that is the corruption that's taking place within international organizations, private companies, American companies, and perhaps even Western officials. And there was a new audit that came out yesterday from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan, which pointed out that the United States itself has failed to develop its own anti-corruption strategy for Afghanistan.
Let's talk also about Pakistan. Lots of bad news in Pakistan this week, both politically and with this natural disaster, this flooding. Lots of people have died already, Elise.
The floods are terrible, the worst in 80 years. You've had more than 1,500 people dead, about 3 million affected by the flooding, and about 500,000 people evacuated from their homes. And this vast destruction, the government is really battling, has this huge battle with insurgents right now in the tribal areas where the floods are being affected the most. And the government is ill-equipped to handle this right now. And you've seen a lot of anger among the people that the government is ill-equipped. And so the U.S. right now is rushing, really making such an intense effort to flood the country, so to speak, no pun intended, with aid because instability for two reasons. First of all, the U.S. wants to show Pakistan that it's there for them. Secretary Clinton just got back from Pakistan with this strategic partnership, really trying to sew up the relationship with Pakistan, but also has to you know, protect the fragile relationship between Pakistan and its people. Because if instability, if the floods, the economy is really terrible right now, and if people are out of their homes, they don't have a job, they're devastated by flooding, disease could come into the country, this is bad for, you know, security in the country, and it's bad for the United States.
You know, the president of Pakistan has made a mistake, a political mistake no American politician would make. Disaster in his country. He's in Europe.
Not only is he in Europe, right now he's in Britain, staying reportedly in a suite in the luxury Hyatt Regency Hotel in London that costs $11,000 per night. There with a huge entourage, which has taken up an entire executive floor, half the rooms not filled because of security reasons. And then this weekend, his political party, the People's Party, the Pakistan People's Party, have spent reportedly £40,000 renting a massive arena in the city of Birmingham for a huge rally at which his son, Bilawal, who was recent, his son he had with Benazir Bhutto, the late Benazir Bhutto, is going to make his first political speech. And it's a speech that's expected to kind of chart his pathway as his father and mother's successor. Meanwhile, back in their country, you have this incredible deluge that has displaced and affected more than 4 million people. There's more than 1,600 people who are dead. And at the same time all of that has gone on, you've had some of the worst ethnic rioting and killing in their biggest city, Karachi, this week, that erupted over the murder, the assassination of a local politician.
Now, James Kitfield, let's talk about some of those, some of that violence, an ethnic element to it.
Yeah, I mean, it was apparently a Shia, I believe, politician. It was anti-Shia groups then who sort of went wild and killed, I think, 70 plus people. At the same time, in the northern area where this where these floods are and where we think Al-Qaeda and a lot of the worst extremist groups are sort of located, the Taliban killed a senior security official that was closely aligned with the United States in the counterterrorism effort. So there's a real – anytime Pakistan starts looking wobbly, you start getting very frightened. And this was just a very bad week, along with the floods and the killings and the ethnic violence south. And then you have this the sort of patina of Zardari, who, after he leaves Britain, apparently was planning to go to his chateau in the south of France. Maybe he'll rethink that now. I hope so. But it's just not a good week for Pakistan.
What happened in Karachi this week in terms of the ethnic violence breaking out, revenge killings for the assassination of this party leader in Karachi of the ruling party? I mean, Pakistan has a lot of religious and ethnic polarization, and I think this really exposed what's going on throughout the country. Revenge attacks, torching, more than 50 dead. And the government is blaming the Taliban trying to destabilize the country, which is possible. And at the same time, back to the flooding, you have the Taliban and other groups really trying to exploit this opportunity to fill the vacuum of unmet aid that the government is not delivering. And you've had these Islamic charities trying to set up camps, distribute food. The Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban said this week that it would suspend attacks so that, aid could get through in some areas. And so the Taliban is really exploiting all of this bad week that the government had this week. And that's very concerning because, again, it's really, at the end of the day, yes, it's about security, but it's about winning hearts and minds. And that's one of the reasons that the U.S. is really trying to send a message to Pakistan that it's going to work with the government to help out. I might also add that the U.S. started this texting campaign where Americans can text, $10, and the U.S. is really trying to get Americans to give. They're really trying to create this partnership with the Pakistanis.
Indeed, one of the groups that is set up aid camps and are feeding people are categorized by the United Nations as a front group for Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is the terrorist organization that staged the attacks in Mumbai. Going back to the whole issue of Pakistan's economy, which is in incredibly bad shape, the violence, every time there's violence in Karachi, that has a huge impact on the economy because Karachi is the financial capital, the business capital of Pakistan, and it's the main port where all its imports and exports go out of. So you close down the port, you have really serious problems. And it's unclear who's responsible for the assassination of the politician belonging to the MQM, which is the ruling party in Karachi. Now, if there's a need for Mr. Zardari, President Zardari, to be back in the country, as well as trying to give succor to his people, is the fact that the MQM, the people that are they are their workers are fighting as a result of this assassination in Karachi, they are fighting a party that represents Pashtuns, the ANP, the Awami National Party. Those parties are both part of Mr. Zardari's national government, and they're at each other's throats, assassinating each other's workers.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to the phones and invite our listeners to join our conversation. We'll go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and talk to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? Listen, I want to congratulate your spirited panelists today. I'm really happy with the vigor that they're addressing the issues, particularly the one regarding General Lavelle. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I was in and out of there before, well, maybe this was going on, but before it really hit. And I always felt bad, for him, and that was sort of part and parcel for the way that, things went for the military over there.
All right, Tom. Tom, do you remember this case with General Lavelle? I know he had to testify, for instance, before congressional hearings, trying to defend himself. Were you following that at the time?
Yes, I did, and I was in the Army, but I did follow, and I believe he was a West Pointer who went into the Air Force and had a very distinguished career in the Air Force, and I'm happy that however late it comes, at least it got some, it got rectified to an extent, but
yeah.
I did appreciate the vigor that your one panelist, and I apologize for not remembering his name, addressed that issue.
All right, Tom, thanks for your call, and thanks for your service to our country. Here's an email we've gotten from another Vietnam vet who's listening on KSTX in San Antonio. He says, here we are negotiating with Vietnam. I think that's a wonderful idea. I spent nearly three years there as a soldier. I would go back if I could afford the trip. What is it going to take to open Cuba up? It's terrible that we are free to visit virtually everywhere on the planet where at one time American blood was shed in some conflict, but Cuba doesn't have that particular status. What do you think, Elise?
Well, there are a lot of efforts in Congress and in the advocacy Cuba activist community to try and overturn the travel ban. You might remember that when last year President Obama did loosen some of the restrictions allowing Cuban Americans to travel to Cuba more often and send these remittances back home that the Bush administration curtailed. There is a lot of support for overturning the full travel ban in Congress. Some congressmen and senators think that they do have enough to overturn it. There are a lot of delegations going on there right now. But you also have, the U.S. doesn't, sees that there are some openings in Cuba, doesn't want to go too far, too fast. You also have an American, Alan Gross, a U.S. contractor that was arrested. He was distributing cell phones to Jewish groups, and he's been in detention for some time. This is clearly an irritant. But I think that the U.S. and Cuba are continuing to talk a little bit more about other issues, migration, postal service. I think they're slowly starting to walk towards each other. And I do think in this administration, you will see some action on that.
James.
I think that's right. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a prisoner release by Raul Castro, and a lot of those prisoners were returned to Spain. Spain kind of brokered the release. But that was the political prisoners. That was a huge opening, I think, from Cuba to say that they're doing – that's one of the chief things we've argued that they need to do to show good faith. I think they've done that. I think there is kind of a rapprochement, very cautiously, because this thing can be demagogued very easily politically. But I think there is this sort of – I know the Obama administration, when they first came in, was hoping to move faster on sort of reopening some sort of relationship with Cuba, but it just fell to the bottom of a very long agenda.
Now, some people think that we'll have to see the death of Fidel Castro before there's a real opening with Cuba. Do you think that's true, Jonathan?
Well, he's made clear that he's – kind of moving in the general direction of trying to normalize things. But I think there's a concern about what will happen with the death of Raul Castro, what will happen within Cuba itself. And that's something that's just not really predictable at the moment.
I think the attitude of activists and people that support overturning and formalizing relations with Cuba is that it's going to be too late by then. Is that once Fidel Castro dies, the floodgates are going to open up, and in some ways, you know, they're not going to need it as much. What they need it is right now. So when then that moment happens, the U.S. is on the ground ready to help Cubans make the transition.
You know, we've opened relations with Vietnam. We haven't opened up with Cuba because, in part, because of the politics, especially in Florida. James, is that changing?
It is changing. The new generation of Cuban Americans in South Florida show a lot more tolerance for the idea of opening up, being able to go back home actually and see their former homeland or the former homeland of their parents. There remains a very hardcore group who absolutely want nothing to do with Cuba as long as Fidel Castro is ruling there. But I think they're starting to pass more from the scene, and I think there is sort of a generational shift there.
Just one more point. I mean, my personal opinion is that this is all about politics. I mean, Cuba is on the state sponsor of terrorism list. It's got all of these U.S. sanctions that we've lifted on other countries for so many other things. The reason that the Cuba is on all these lists and subject to a lot of sanctions, not all of them, is politics.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll come back to the phones. Our lines are open. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. We've got a couple open lines. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The novel A Happy Marriage by Rafael Iglesias is based on his memories of meeting his wife, falling in love, and getting married, and what it was like years later when she died. The book was described in the New York Times as a profound deliberation on the nature of love, marriage, and the process of dying. On the next Fresh Air, Iglesias talks about the novel, which comes out in paperback next week. Join us.
President Obama made a speech on Monday to a veterans group in Atlanta. He talked about the U.S. commitment in Iraq. Elise, what did he say?
Well, he said that the U.S. would maintain a long-term commitment to Iraq in terms of the ever-growing civilian presence on there. But he spoke about bringing the war in Iraq to a responsible end. And he's saying that the August 31st deadline for the military to bring the troops down to 50,000 is the closing of a chapter, and that the U.S. is going to be transitioning towards a more normal relationship with Iraqis, as it does with many other countries. I mean, this is really for the U.S. kind of signaling the end of so-called occupation. But what you have right now is a 5-month deadlock on the government forming up. You have the drawdown of U.S. troops and a lot of, you know, instability in the country. You've seen a lot more violence. Al-Qaeda is doing a lot more recruiting to try and fill this void right now that the government isn't meeting because it's very much deadlocked. And the U.S. is concerned that it's going to be leaving the country as there's more instability in the country. And you even saw Tariq Aziz, the deputy to Saddam Hussein, say, "Don't leave Iraq right now. You're leaving them to the wolves." So, I mean, it kind of signals that U.S. is growing increasingly worried that the government won't be in place before all these troops come out and America's clout diminishes further.
But, you know, in a way, there was no news in President Obama's speech. He's simply reaffirming what he said before. So why give the speech?
Oh, I think there was some, I want to be really cynical about this. I mean, he's facing these congressional elections coming up in November, in which his party has got an uphill battle, facing an uphill battle. And at the same time, he's sent an additional at least 52,000 more American troops to a place called Afghanistan. The other thing that I feel is, when I look at this in a cynical way, is the fact that he's meeting requirements that were actually negotiated with Iraq by the Bush administration. And it seems, you know, the deadlines for getting American troops, combat troops out, the deadline for getting all American troops out. The fact is that he seemed to be trying to take credit. He used the expression, American combat troops will be out by the end of this month, quote, as promised and on schedule, unquote, as if he's the guy who's fulfilling this promise when indeed these are required under an agreement that the Bush administration negotiated with the Iraqi government.
James?
I guess when Tariq Aziz asked you to stay, it's pretty much time to go. But I to be a slightly less cynical take on this, I mean, the milestone is important. It gets us at the end of August, we're going to be down to 50,000, half of what we had this time last year in Iraq. The mission does change from and it already has been changing from a combat mission to primarily train and equip and some counterterrorism operations. But Jonathan's absolutely right. When he's making the speech, what I'm hearing is, look, we know things are tough in Afghanistan right now, but they were tough in Iraq in 2007 when General Petraeus did his surge there. And look, right now we're pulling out of Iraq and leaving something there that can stand on its own two legs. If you stick with me in Afghanistan, this is what will happen in a couple of years in Afghanistan as well.
I agree with that, but I also think that we could see a backward sliding in Iraq. I mean, not only do you have the combat troops leaving, you have a new ambassador coming in, Jim Jeffrey, who is, by all accounts, a wonderful diplomat. But at the same time, there is more uncertainty. You have a new top general, commanding general in Iraq. You have a new commander of CENTCOM. You continue to have this deadlock. That's why when Mullen went out there this week, he said, get your act together, Iraqi government. You need to stand up with the government. Vice President Biden went out there recently. Secretary Clinton has been making calls. They are very concerned about this potential vacuum if the government doesn't stand up soon.
And in fact, that doesn't appear like it's going to happen because we're just about the Muslim world is just about to begin a month long, the month of fasting, of Ramadan. Nothing will happen either there or even in a place like Afghanistan where you need to have political action on a whole number of fronts. So, yes, there is concern is increasing. And while you have this vacuum, and they didn't even meet their deadline for selecting a new speaker of their parliament or a president, and it's their president's job to select the next prime minister. So the deadlock there is extremely concerning. And into that vacuum, you have at least U.S. officials are concerned about increasing an expansion of already very significant Iranian influence.
Well, let's talk a bit about Iran. Now, there was a report there was an attack on Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, this week, and then a dispute about whether what had really happened. Do we know what happened with Ahmadinejad?
The reports I read were fairly sketchy. There was apparently some sort of an attack, but it didn't have any real effect on his convoy. He gave the speech that he was planning to give just after that. So I don't imagine it was any very well coordinated attack. But there apparently was some sort of incident on his convoy.
Iranian officials said it might have just been a firecracker.
The news began there was a sort of a government allowed website that a grenade had been thrown at Ahmadinejad's convoy. That was very quickly replaced by this version that came out on state-run television, and then this item was removed from the website that it, in fact, had been a firecracker. So it's unclear what happened.
Meanwhile, President Obama talked with a small group of journalists this week, including David Ignatius, a friend of the Friday News Roundup, about his attitude toward Iran. What did he say, Elise?
Well, these journalists were invited to a backgrounder by a national security staffer, and President Obama came in. And basically, I think, tried to use it to vindicate his policy on Iran. What he was saying is, we're hearing rumblings from Iran that the sanctions are starting to bite, and that they didn't expect that the sanctions would be as tough as we are. We're in the catbird seat right now. We could be talking to Iran, you know, fairly soon, and kind of saying, like, this was part of my plan. You know, I wanted to, you know, make a big effort at nonproliferation. I wanted to show Iran I'm not the aggressor. I wanted to show Iran that, you know, there's an open hand. And I also want to continue to engage. And so what he's saying is, you know, we may have an opportunity pretty soon through this P5 plus one, these UN Security Council members plus Germany and the EU to start talking to Iran. We're going to continue the sanctions. Really, it was just kind of a reiteration of what his policy is, but he thinks it's pretty successful. The Iranians are having trouble right now with their nuclear program, with their centrifuges. It's not going as smoothly as anticipated. So the U.S. feels it's in a pretty strong position right now. Also could outstretch a hand to Iran to start talking about Afghanistan, because you really need the regional players to be on board with this, and the neighbors. And so I think it was a opportunity to come in and say, hey, you know, for all your writing about Iran, it's really going the way I planned all along.
James?
I talked to Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg this week, and he's very much on that line that, you know, this everyone, a lot of Republicans criticize Obama for having its outstretched hand slapped away by Iran, supposedly making the United States look weak. And their argument is, and I think it's a compelling argument, that by reaching out to Iran and having Iran slap that hand away, it made it possible for the rest of the world to come to coalesce around this group of sanctions that the UN Security Council passed, with Russia and China on board, and the European Union and us and a number of other countries went well beyond those sanctions and introduced even more sanctions. And there are indications that Iran is uncomfortable with this. It typically is uncomfortable when there's a successful isolation like we're seeing of it right now. They are going to be, Ahmadinejad's going to be in New York for the Security Council General Assembly opening next month. That's always a time when he sort of kind of hints that he might be interested in talk. So we'll see if anything comes of this. But it very much plays to the narrative the Obama administration wants to advance, which is this engagement strategy is not weak. In fact, it's tougher than what was going on in the Bush administration.
Jonathan?
I think they need to be a little less optimistic, or a little bit more cautious in their optimism. First of all, when President Obama did this briefing, it happened that the Iranian oil minister was in China, and China gets a vast amount of its petroleum product from Iran and doesn't want to see that supply constrained. That's the first point. The second point is that Iran in the past has not really responded to this pressure in the way that it was expected to. There are two sets of talks coming up, it looks like, in September, one with the so-called P5 plus two, and that will deal with the overall issue of Iran and its nuclear program. But then there's a separate set of talks they hope to get going over this idea that Iran should export out of the country, at least temporarily, uranium that it's enriched to 20%. And that means that uranium could be seed for uranium fuel for its nuclear weapons, for an alleged nuclear weapons program. But Iran has always used these opportunities to sort of fiddle-faddle the international system. And the fact that China, it's sort of still talking to them about their petroleum. Russia has come out very critical of the additional sanctions that the EU and the U.S. has put on Iran. So we have to wait and see. One last very important point. I think the other significance of the president being, quote-unquote, the briefer was as a message to Israel. Israel has not ruled out the possibility that it could stage its own airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. And this could very well have been a message to the president, from the president to Netanyahu and the Israelis, which is, I got things under control. The sanctions are starting to work. Stop putting pressure on us to move towards the military option. We think the diplomatic option is working.
Let's go back to the phones. Jim's been very patient holding on from Salt Lake City, Utah. Jim, thank you for holding on. Jim, are you there? Hi, go ahead.
Hello. Well, you know, I'm an avid listener to NPR, and I was really struck this week by interviews with Man on the Street, a reporter from Pakistan, was accumulating emails, and he had tallied up about 300 emails. And he said that there were two basic themes of these people on the street experiencing the flood. One theme was this was Allah punishing them, and they need to get back to Allah and closer to the Quran. And the other theme was the government let the dams break, which is false. So when I hear the man on the street saying that in Pakistan, that we have to get closer to Allah, it seems just desperate and sad, and it will never work there. And I think we have to look at that reality and try to foster a more peaceful Islam.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. Jonathan.
I think you have to take a much more nuanced view of what's going on here. Pakistan is a conservative Muslim nation, for sure. Islam is the strongest influence in the country. However, the Pakistanis differentiate between religious Islam and political Islam. The fact is they don't elect, unless there is rigging, and this has happened in the past, they don't elect Islamist politicians to their legislatures. They prefer to go with the much more secular politicians. So I think you have to take a much more nuanced view of that attitude in Pakistan.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've gotten an emailer, Josh, in Durham, North Carolina, who points out that President Obama sent a representative to Japan to represent the U.S. today at the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, the first time a U.S. official has participated in that ceremony. What is the significance, do you think, Elise?
That's right. Ambassador Roos is going to lead the U.S. delegation, and there's been a lot of question about whether the U.S. is going to apologize for Hiroshima. You saw some comments yesterday by Secretary Clinton really pushing the idea that this administration believes in nonproliferation and doesn't believe in using weapons against other countries. And this fueled a lot of questions about whether there would be apology. The U.S. saying, no apology. We're going to mark the event, and we think it's appropriate to be represented.
Now we're going to have a first on the Friday News Roundup International Hour by playing a little hip hop, and we'll tell you why afterwards.
Obama, yeah. Hillary Clinton. They got competition. They got competition. Vote for me, yeah. Vote for me. Mr. Clifford, the president.
Elise, who is performing there?
That's Wyclef Jean of the Fugees. He also has another song that's called If I Were President. And actually, he's going to run for president of Haiti. This is a Haitian who has been living in America since he was a young boy. He is very active in the Haitian community. And after the earthquake, his charity, the Yele Haiti Foundation, raised about $9 million. He's been a real outspoken activist in terms of getting the international community to give to Haiti. Now says that he is going to be running for president. There's a lot of buzz in the country. A lot of people think that he's a very strong front runner because of his international status. But at the same time, there's been a lot of questions about his foundation, about the management of it, about possible charges of embezzlement, and he owes some money to the IRS. So I think it's going to be a difficult slog for him, but it's certainly exciting for Haitians right now.
He went to Port-au-Prince yesterday and filed the papers to run. Jonathan?
There's also a question about his eligibility under Haitian's election laws and constitution as to whether or not he's going to be allowed to run. The eligibility requirements require a candidate to have lived in Haiti for 5 consecutive years. Mr. Jean has not done that. And he claims that, you know, he is a roving ambassador for Haiti. So he claims the fact that he has had to Rove means that he hasn't been able to be in the country for the five consecutive years, and he wants an exemption from that requirement. The other interesting aspect of this is if he is allowed to run, one of his major opponents will be his uncle, who is the current Haitian ambassador to the United States.
Just briefly, James, it's been just over 6 months since that terrible earthquake in Haiti. How is Haiti doing?
Well, it's coming. I mean, they're making progress, but it's slow. I mean, there was so much destruction in that country that it's going to take years and years to really sort of get people out of these tent cities and back into with roofs over their heads. But you know, we elected a movie star as president. A lot of Americans thought Reagan turned out pretty well, so maybe it's Haiti's turn to elect a hip hopper.
We're going to give the last word to Naomi. She sends us a comment on Facebook. She says Wyclef Jean has the opportunity to be an icon of hope and help. Because of his fame around the world, he has a foothold where an unknown candidate would not. He also seems to have his heart in the right place in regards to what needs to be done for Haiti. Well, I want to thank our panel for being with us this hour on the News Roundup. James Kitfield, senior correspondent with National Journal Magazine. Elise Labbitt, senior State Department producer for CNN. And Jonathan Lande, senior national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.